Well, Tony Sears is the chair of our local community board, and there's always plenty going on there to keep things busy, but he's also got a responsibility on the island for civil defence. And I don't know whether or not it was prompted by the recent tsunami threats that have approached the island, but recently there's been a bit of attention going on about the preparedness of the island for civil defence, and there was a public meeting along those lines just last week. Tony, welcome to the studio.
Thanks, Chris. Well, really good to be here.
Okay, and so what was the focus of that meeting?
Well, the public meeting that we had was more an education meeting, just going through the basic civil defence preparedness that families and households should have in terms of any sort of civil defence disaster. So the meeting that day was pretty much the same as would have been rolled out right through Auckland. However, there is intention of having another public meeting very soon. From memory, it is June the 29th, Tuesday, June the 29th, from 6 to 8.30 at the Ostend War Memorial Hall. And that'll be an opportunity for people to come along who have issues or concerns or questions related to Waiheke's preparedness for a civil defence emergency.
So you're pretty involved with the civil defence set up on the island, and what's the feeling about the relationship with Auckland Civil Defence? Because there was a bit of feeling perhaps around that last tsunami threat that the information that was available was focused on Auckland rather than Waiheke specifically.
Sure. As I understand it, there is no way that Waiheke can initiate its own civil defence warnings. Unless it is in conjunction with the rest of the Greater Auckland region. That's the concerns that I think have been expressed for a while, and I have some concerns about that. The reality is that if there is a tsunami, the information would come from Auckland anyway. It's just a matter of how prepared we are in terms of raising alerts on our own island. The message that I've received countless times is that we can't just go out and initiate a warning unless we've got the approval or the go-ahead of the Greater Auckland region. To some extent, you can understand that. You'd have a whole lot of little communities all over New Zealand setting up their own little warnings, and what Civil Defence want to do is have a national and a regional, then a local plan.
So there must be a number of instances where the degree of concern or the threat or the incident or whatever is a little bit lower perhaps than, you know, what would warrant a full civil defence call out, but is still of enough magnitude that some kind of response is needed.
Sure. I mean, I'm concerned about something like if there was a gas leak in Tahi Road at the gas station, you know. I would like to see that we have processes in place on our own island for initiating some sort of civil defence warning to our islanders, you know. I guess for many civil defence emergencies, there isn't going to be any warning. I mean, tsunami is one of those fortunate ones now where we have got measurements in place that will record sometimes hours before an event what's going to happen. But, you know, things like earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, they may have little warning at all, you know. So it's about the readiness of our island to do things once those happen. And I'm pretty confident that we've got things pretty well in place. There are civil defence management plans in place for our island. The fact that we haven't had to use them so far, you know, has been a lucky thing, but it doesn't mean that they don't exist.
And I suppose there's also many things which perhaps on the mainland might not be an issue. I'm thinking of things like, say, the supermarket fire, which here take on a different kind of scale.
For sure. You know, one of the concerns that some people have is the amount of food that we have, you know, on our island, and the fact that in some particular civil defence emergencies we may not have transport backwards and forwards from Waiheke to the Isthmus. Living on an island, we are separated, and we do have to, I guess, be a little bit more prepared. And I think the message that goes out to all people on Waiheke is the same as it's been thrashed on the television, that, you know, everybody, all families, should take some personal responsibility for ensuring that they have an emergency pack that contains things like torches and radios and enough food for 3 or 4 days and water. You know, I think we think that because we've got a little tank right beside our house, we don't need to worry about that because it's always there. But in an earthquake, it's likely that that might not be there.
So, I mean, this goes a bit of a doomsday scenario, but you know, say you know, I don't know, volcanic eruption or something like that, and we are isolated, you know, cut off for quite some period of time. Are there powers to like commandeer the food in the supermarket and the petrol stations and so on? You know, the petrol and fuel to provide to ensure that there is kind of adequate provision and it's not in you know best dressed and most money in the wallet who prevail.
To be honest, you know, that scenario hasn't been discussed. You know, I think that you know Waiheke is pretty much a community, and I would be hoping that, that if there was any eventuality like that where we were out of food for an extended period of time, I believe that all groups would come together to work together, you know, and I'm sure that the supermarket would be part of that group.
The community garden would be very popular.
Yeah, true. And the farms, of course, you know, but I guess it's not something we should wait till it happens, but it's something that I haven't discussed with the powers that be. I'm assuming that if in any sort of disaster there is a committee and the police and emergency services and so on are all part of that committee, so they would give us a pretty good idea about what we can and cannot do. You know, I mean, I just felt that at the last tsunami warning, we were able to ring up Fullers and say, hey, can you go and put on a bus and go and grab everybody from the retirement village and take them to the RSA? And the RSA happily fed them, and then we put them back on a bus and took them back home, and 3 or 4 hours later, and they'd had a good day out. But it just goes to show that the community spirit is still there and that things will happen, you know. You just have to ring the right people and ask. And you know, I'm confident that if there was some sort of emergency where the community was isolated for any period of time, the community would get together.
And so really, I suppose it's just a matter of identifying who are the people who make those calls, not assuming that someone else is doing it. Mm-hmm. And have you got, I suppose, a list somewhere of, you know, what are the things we might need and who do we contact?
Yeah, we have. And the last tsunami warning was a good example and really kind of shook down some of that. I have a list that's updated pretty well every month of key numbers. You'd be pleased to know that Waiheke Radio is on that list. So, I mean, if we wanted to contact, say, all the tourist, also all the holiday accommodation, you know, we've got a list of all the hotels, pretty much, all, the transport services, individual areas, rural communities, people who are sort of like the key messengers in those areas. That list is getting bigger and bigger, and you've got to be careful, otherwise you end up with a telephone book. But the list is dynamic and you know, a pretty good list, I think, if we needed to rely on ourselves.
Good stuff. That's good to hear. And the date of that meeting again?
Tuesday the 29th of June from 6 to 8.30 in the Ostend War Memorial Hall.
Okay, and that's kind of about home preparedness, isn't it?
Well, it's going to be more than that. I mean, what happened is regularly civil defence come out to Waiheke and give their spiel, their normal preparedness spiel. But there are people on our island who have expressed concerns about how prepared we are, and particularly about early warning notification. And so we wanted the public meeting, the one that we had last week, to focus a little bit more on Waiheke issues. Council came back to us and said, well, look, you know, we're prepared to do that at another time. We're rolling out this particular one across Auckland. Let's choose another time when we can do one for Waiheke. And so this meeting, the second meeting, is going to be predominantly looking at Waiheke issues and some of the very issues that you've raised today. I think there are concerns. I think we are different. It'll be interesting because I've already appointed a person for civil defence as part of the super city structure, man, I think, from up north. And so it's going to be interesting to see how Waiheke fits into all of that. And more importantly, it's going to be interesting to see how local boards, what sort of powers local boards will have in terms of civil defence emergency management too.
Yeah, not many, I'm guessing. Yeah, like everything else. I'm talking to Tony Sears, Chair of the Waiheke Community Board, and there's been an ongoing issue around leases, community leases, for some of the tenants of artworks for quite some time, of the council introducing a new kind of hybrid lease which looked at the income of community groups and, based on that income, decided whether or not, well, are they going to get a full community lease or are they going to have to pay some kind of hybrid, which is a mix of a commercial or community lease, or in some cases arguing they should pay a full commercial lease. And that's been ongoing with those groups and between those groups and council for quite some time. The community board, of course, has been in there supporting and trying to seek a resolution, and I believe we're getting somewhere, Tony.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's been a long battle, and you're never sure if the battle's ever won. The concept of hybrid leases is still around, and it's a bit of a worry. But essentially what happened is that most of the many of the tenants on artworks have had their incomes looked at and been told that anything over $100,000 incurs a 5% tax to the council. This has had huge ramifications for all of the groups, particularly the Art Gallery and the Theatre Trust and the Cinema Trust. And so we've been really, and the Waste Resource Trust as well, and so we've been really fighting to see the removal of the hybrid leases or to get some sense in there. And as I understand it now, the Art Gallery is now on a community lease. I understand the transfer station is on a hybrid lease, but it's going from being a full commercial thing of paying something like $700 a month down to, you know, maybe a couple of hundred dollars a month. There's still issues with the theatre, but we're working through resolving some of those. So, you know, by and large, I think we're kind of getting there, but it's having to fight piece by piece and inch by inch on the battleground.
Yeah. And, I mean, what's the thinking behind this? Because it looks at income, doesn't it? And the argument of those groups is that, well, you know, we're spending all of that income back into community organisations.
Yeah. The reality is that to provide the sort of service that some of these community groups want to do, they have to make some money just to keep going. So
that's not something we've tried.
No, but you kind of do. Otherwise, you're just relying on handouts all the time, either from the community board, which is a good source of money, and rightly so, or from the community. You know, so you know the Art Gallery has a shop and it is selling pieces of art. Now, you know that art can be very expensive, so it doesn't take many pieces of art to get over $100,000, for example. You know, and that's not to say that they've having an income of $100,000, they might only be making $10,000 on that work, but then they're being charged another 5% over and above that, and that's where things become really tricky. My argument is that you shouldn't be trying to, if you're going to have this sort of tax or this rent tax on buildings, you shouldn't be doing it on their income, you should be doing it on their profit. The council's argument is, well, profit is easy to massage and you can hide things within your profit, so therefore we'd rather do it on income. I think it's simpler for them and easier for them, but I don't think it's fairer.
Mm. So we've still got some movement, still a little bit to resolve?
Well, I think, you know, the concept, we asked for a review and we got a review of the hybrid lease system. By and large, it doesn't affect anywhere else in Auckland. You know, I've been to the community board chairs meetings and I've asked them and told them about our concerns, and they've all sort of nodded their heads wisely. But to most of those community boards, it has no effect at all. You know, Waiheke is one of those few places, because of our isolation, that does have some very strong community organisations that are doing things in the community. Whereas in other areas of Greater Auckland, that's not the case. So there are very few people affected by hybrid leases outside of Waiheke. You know, it seems like all the attention is on artworks, which is bizarre when you think about it, given that many of the very buildings that people are occupying now are going to be extinct in a short time. You know, why would they bother to go to all this stress? Why don't they just let them roll over till the buildings, such as this particular one here, is knocked down?
Yes, a very good question indeed. All right, well, good to see that there is some movement on that, and thank you very much, Tony, for popping in this morning.
It's nice to be here, Chris. Thank you very much.
in the recent budget, most of the attention has gone on to the tax cuts and the GST increases and what that's going to mean for people's pockets. But also in the budget were some other very significant changes and some quite significant cuts. And the area that received the greatest magnitude of cuts was early childhood education, where there was hundreds of millions of dollars pulled out of that budget area. And that's going to have some implications for the provision of childcare and right across the country and, of course, here on Waiheke Island, because it's based around the number of teachers who are qualified and registered and the funding rates that go along with that. So it's a pretty complex issue. So here to talk with us about it is Uta Hoffman, who's the Senior Teacher and Manager of Waiheke Community Childcare Centre. Good morning, Uta.
Good morning, Chris.
So first of all, let's talk about the scope of these cuts. So what does it, you know, people hear, oh, okay, there's some funding cuts to community childcare. What does it mean? What does it mean for the centre?
It is fairly dramatic for us at the Community Childcare Centre, as we have placed a huge emphasis on qualified, fully registered staff, because we believe in quality early childhood education, because we know that that has a huge impact on young people's life. I believe, and we believe, that the future of this country is in our children, and the quality that we can give them now is going to benefit the society of tomorrow.
So at present, do you receive funding, which is the funding rates which are available to you, are they dependent on the percentage of qualified staff that you have?
What's been happening for us in the last 2 years is that we have been very fortunate to have student teachers that are fully committed and dedicated to their course of studies, and one of them has finished now and the other one will be finished at the end of the year. And also we have very good, highly qualified registered teachers at the centre. So that means for us that by the end of this year we will have 100% qualified registered staff, which is really a wonderful thing. But this government is going to punish us for what the last government was going to pay us. And it means that 80% of our registered qualified teachers will be funded by the government, but 20% will not be funded. So in other words, I should be looking at making a saving in my cost of wages if I want to make ends meet.
So that, I presume, puts early childhood education centres in a pretty difficult position. So what options does it leave you to make up the shortfall of funding?
As we are committed and dedicated to quality care, it will mean that we will have to go up in our fees, which will be hard for some of our parents and is not really in our interest. We will have to look at our ratios. We believe that good ratios are important, as they mean quality interactions between children and adults. And in order to have that quality, you need a certain amount of teachers on the floor. So we're not a babysitting institution. We actually believe in quality education. You need to have a good amount of teachers on the floor, being able to spend that time with the children, and that costs us money. So the other way of dealing with it would be to cut those ratios, have less teachers for more amount of children, which will mean less quality interactions, and that's not really what we're about. And the other option that we have, of course, is to spend time in fundraising and get parents involved in that, and our parent committee involved in that, which means, of course, a lot of time is going to be spent on probably very little money coming in.
So you talked about that you've been on this kind of pathway trying to achieve a fully qualified staff for quite some time. So how long has that been the policy to move towards full qualification?
It's been with the last government, in fact, probably actually much longer than that. The target was that we would have 100% qualified teachers by 2010. Which we have not achieved due to the fact that there weren't enough places available for people studying early childhood education. And so it was actually not possible to have that many people trained. Also, there's a huge demand in New Zealand for early childhood care, as we see it on the island as well. We have a long wait list. So people actually need early childhood care, early childhood education, but we're not offering enough. So the government's changed the target to 2012, but with this new policy of cutting the funding, it will mean that we will not reach this target because the incentive is gone. There's the incentive to study early childhood education and get a job has been really, it's been knee-jerked, and it's very sad, I think.
So did you have any prior warning that this funding change would come and there would be such a dramatic change in the policy?
Not really, no. It's been a big shock to us. There were rumours and there was tension around the new budget coming out, but no, we weren't prepared at all.
So, you know, many people think, okay, they know that they have qualified teachers at their schools, but this is early childhood education. It's not compulsory to go. Why is it so important to have qualified teachers?
Well, we now know, and research has clearly proved this, that every dollar you spend on early childhood education will come back. Will get back $13 later on, because it means children go to school well prepared, their foundation skills are in place, and they are ready and able to learn. Early childhood education is so varied, and we are very fortunate in New Zealand to have a fantastic curriculum, Te Whariki, which is highly regarded worldwide. So we actually are able to offer quality education for our young ones, and as I said before, this will benefit our society and our communities in the future. And I think it is important to raise the uptake of early childhood education, and that's been always a push too with the last government and this government to offer this type of education to lower socioeconomic groups in our country. And because we know that if we get these children to participate, they will do so much better in school and later on in life. They will be finishing school, they will be able to engage in tertiary education and have better jobs.
And have you been getting feedback from parents at all about their reaction to the budget and the possible implications?
Parents have been quite concerned. Obviously, they're concerned about what it will mean for their own pockets. I think it will mean that some parents will not be able to participate in early childhood education, and that's really backfiring, because those would probably be exactly the type of families and children that would benefit the most from early childhood education. So this will have a big effect, and parents have, mentioned their concern and their worry about this.
And do you have plans to take those concerns to the government in any way?
I have got a meeting with Jacinda Ardern on the 21st of June. She will be coming to visit us at the childcare centre, and hopefully before then I will be able to meet with a group of parents, certainly with our committee, to come up with a plan of how we're going to address this issue.
Great. Okay, so you've already determined, have you, that the fees will increase? Or?
Yeah, we will certainly have to look at increasing our fees, because the budget cuts are quite complex. Of course, the GST is going up. We have to pay GST on our funding, so we're doubly punished. We are going to lose that funding for our extra 20% of qualified teachers. And also there will be cuts to the 23 hours per hourly funding per child. So we're actually not entirely sure how badly this will hit us, but there have been predictions that some centres will suffer 25% losses. And I'm not sure exactly how we sit in that, but it will be a dramatic cut, and we won't be able to cover this with fees only.
Wow, so it's pretty serious.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so I suppose if people do are concerned and want to know more about how they can do something about this, maybe then they should stay in contact with the centre or the centre where their children go.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this government will listen to parents. This is the government we have voted for as a country, and I think it's time that we let this government know how their choices and decisions impacting on our youngest citizens.
Right. Okay, Uta Hoffman, that's the Senior Teacher Manager of Waiheke Community Childcare Centre. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke People, Events and Issues, brought to you by Island, Art, Craft, Giftware, Clothing and Bric-a-Brac, Ocean View Road, Oniroa.
But right now I'm talking to Di from Waiheke Library. How are you, Di?
Good morning, Chris. Good, thank you. Good.
Okay, so how are things over there in the land of books?
In the land of books. Yes, it's all busy as usual, of course, and we've got the sun shining and people pouring in the door, which is our usual Saturday morning. Lots of families and people waiting outside for us to open, so that's always a good sign. So, I guess some people might like to know a little bit about the new library and the progress of that. We've met with the architects, us four permanent staff over there, so which has been very assuring and exciting. So we're feeling, because it's been changed slightly, the floor plan, to suit the needs of
us. There were a number of letters to the paper, weren't there, saying this is all wrong. I don't know if it was the same person writing a number of letters or a number of people writing our letter, but saying this is all wrong, it's the wrong shape, it's got round walls, and how can you stack books up, and you know, and the sun's going to come in, and there were a number of things like that. Were they right or were they wrong?
Yes and no, because there has been, so it's been adapted to kind of bring in a little bit more of more wall space for the books, because that was a concern of ours too. But that it did seem that whole curve was all glass, and it's not to be like that now. So it's really become a lot more functional. So there's glass, and there's quite a lot, 8 or 10 metres of wall, and then more glass. So that's really, you know, we are really pleased with that. And the end where there was a point, and that's now been cut off, so that there's more usable space and makes it way more functional on both floors, because there's that mezzanine up top and the floor down the bottom. So no, we're looking, and the teens area is really funky with the big screen at the end for them, and it's kind of looking, yeah, we're encouraged and looking forward to it. And the collection does fit in, so, and there's a lot of space for different needs as well, you know, so yeah, I think it'll be good.
Okay, and so construction maybe start of next year, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, it is, so that's all go. We've just had the Story Festival, and the library always takes part in that, and we were open on Sunday, which is the only Sunday in the year that we're open, and Fiona, our manager, takes over that one. And we had like 200 people. I mean, I know Artworks is busy at that weekend, but in the back of our minds, we'd quite like to open on a Sunday, and that's probably a definite with the new library anyway, and it will be interesting to see how that goes, as you know, our Sunday, like just a 10 to a 1 or something.
Are there other libraries around the city that open on Sundays?
Yeah, definitely. The central one, of course, and some of the major, the bigger ones, they are all open 7 days a week. Some of our smaller ones aren't, but it's part of the policy to have them open 7 days a week, if it suits, you know, if it works, and
yeah,
so that's part of what we'll be doing in the future.
Good stuff.
Yeah, so we need to say that over in the library, as part of the Story Festival, quite a large blanket was created with appliqued work of children from Where the Wild Things Are by Morris Sendak. So that's going to be on the back wall in the children's area for anybody to come and have a look at and see what they did, and as part of that Story Festival. So that's that. And then what else was that? We got a massive, massive promotion, which often doesn't happen throughout Auckland City Libraries, but this is, you know, everywhere. This is what we're doing for 2 months, and it's called What's Hot at Libraries, and it's really just encouraging people to use our rental collection. So that means CDs, DVDs, audio books, the What's Hot collection, which is the, you know, the books and the magazines, all of the console games. People don't often realise we've got quite a range of console games. So if you hire any of those, you go in the draw, and the sixth one's free, as well as going in the draw to win a $100 voucher for that awesome restaurant on the viaduct called Wildfire. So it's kind of hot, you know, hot, wildfire, all of that. So we're encouraging people to, you know, hire more things during the next 2 months. And the prizes are really good. So that's that one. And we've all got badges to wear, and we've all got the promo marketing stuff to go with it. So that you'll see it in the library quite obviously.
Is there a shift towards, in the balance of stuff that people are taking out, is there a move towards taking out more of that kind of, digital content?
Yeah, because like I've just been with someone in the library this morning, realising that there's an e-book, I've talked about this before. We've got 1,000-odd books in the digital library in the downloadable media section of the databases, and it's, you know, you can download onto an MP3, your iPod, your computer, you can burn it onto your computer, so it's just, you know, it's just so accessible. So, and that's free, and so I'm just trying to encourage more people to use the e-book side of things. And I think for students that works really well. So, and as far as the rentals, definitely in the holidays it seems that there's more people borrow, you know, like especially long weekends, and the DVDs go out a lot more. And we do have quite a different collection to the normal video stores, so people quite like that as well. And of course there's the children's DVDs as well. So I think it does need more of a plug though, and which is I guess why they've chosen to do this system-wide promotion. So you come in and take advantage of the sixth one being free.
Cool.
Yeah. And just a little note about our book club. That's still going really strongly. We meet on a Wednesday at 6 o'clock once a month, and anybody is welcome to join. We still have people coming in and joining up, so do come along. And three of the books that, you know, that we've been reading that folks out there might like to put on their library card and order. A couple of months ago we read Sea of Poppies, and that's the first of a trilogy, so I can't remember the author offhand, but you know, you can just access the catalogue by the Sea of Poppies. Awesome read, sort of based in India with all of the East Indian shipping company stuff and the China, and there's a whole lot of dynamics going on there, but awesome read. And then last month we had Water for Elephants by Sarah Gruen, and we all, like most people in the group, loved that book, and everybody that comes to the counter totally loves it as well. And that's a fascinating look in the life of the circus trains and the living and working in the circus in the 30s in America. Fascinating. And this month we're reading the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society, and of course well known to be a very good read as well. So if anybody wants to copy what the book club's reading, you're most welcome.
Okay.
And I think that's kind of like, you know, just a little tidbits of what's happening at the library.
Excellent. Thanks very much. So yeah, I'll be getting over and checking out those CDs and DVDs. So nice to know you can pick up a free one.
Yes, that's right. So even if you've borrowed five CDs, the sixth one could be a DVD, which is worth more money, but we don't mind. So do take advantage of that. Okay.
Okay, cheers, Di.
Kia ora.
It's not the first Saturday of the month, it's the second Saturday of the month, but I wasn't here last week and I am this week. So this is the week that we're catching up with our opinionated Islanders, Alan Knight and Alex Stone. Good morning to you both.
Morning, morning.
And what a bit of luck we did put it off a week, because what a week it's been.
There has been quite a bit to talk.
Oh, we have so much to get out of.
We certainly do have a lot to talk about. Okay, so first up, people are coming out of the woodwork now, putting up their hands, saying they're going to stand for the community board, and we have quite an array of people who have put their hands up.
Yeah. What an improvement on last time. 3 years ago, the lineup of those people hoping to step into Kellyanne Harvey's shoes was really quite unimpressive. I went to the public meeting. And while we're on the subject, grey power. This time round, can you guys sit down, shut up? Don't attempt to run a public meeting like the disgraceful mess you made of it last time, where none of us were allowed to ask a few searching questions of the candidates, and they were just allowed to stand there and mouth off as much as they wanted. Grey power, stay well out of it this time.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to have the chance to ask some searching questions the candidates.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think there will be, you know, because we're going to be in this whole area of the defining the powers of the board and, you know, and how they want to exercise that. So it's a whole new ball game.
Yeah. You're voting for people who will be standing for as your representative, but you're not sure how they're going to be able to talk on your behalf. Yeah. How they're going to reach the new city? Yeah.
How much? It's so reassuring to see the standard of candidates putting their names forward this time.
Yeah. No, it's all very interesting.
And so, I mean, shall we reel off who we know of so far? Ewan Sutherland.
Yes.
Yes.
Joe Holmes.
Yeah. So we should probably say who these people are. So Ewan Sutherland
is the gardening writer for the Golf News. Anyone who plants things for a living, I reckon, is good for making things grow. I like the sound of that.
Okay. And Joe Holmes.
Yes.
Former editor of The Marketplace.
Yeah. Another intelligent
and
capable
owner.
Person that you trust with something.
And who's
like
contributed solidly to the community for a long time without any wackiness, you know. And maybe we've overplayed the wacky hand in New Zealand, you know. Joe's, I would imagine, would be a very solid candidate. Yeah.
Okay, and who else have we got? I've got a list written down somewhere.
There's Dorte Reyes from the Waste Resource Trust.
Again, somebody you'd He's a lot more confidence in than anyone that stood last time.
Yeah.
And who else have we got on my little list here? Oh, okay. Faye's story?
Yeah, Faye's story. Faye's story. That'll be the interesting thing.
Welcome back, Faye.
Yeah. The only thing that intrigues me about Faye is her announcement of restanding. She was out of town and her partner made the announcement and no one could reach her. So that wasn't
not the most auspicious start, no.
Yeah, but I do think she's got the experience and she's she has the experience of standing up to banks. And I think, you know, when she lost last time, it was very close and she hardly campaigned at all. So maybe she'll campaign a bit more effectively this time and let's see what happens.
There would be many who hoped that she'd never had to stand up to banks again.
Yeah, true.
We've got Paul Walden, a name I don't know actually.
No,
Paul Walden.
No, a bit of a mystery there. I'm not sure who he is.
Well, we might Google him in a minute. Alan Davies.
Oh, not again.
The bus driver. Yes. Yes. Good old Alan.
Yeah. Now, I mean, this is what I was saying about the extremely poor quality of candidates last time. He's an awkward man in public. His performance at the meeting 3 years ago was deeply uninspiring, and then of course he was attempting to stand for a community board seat out in the Waitakere somewhere simultaneously and didn't seem to think that was a problem. Yeah. Well, how wrong you were.
Yeah. But he stood many times, hasn't he? Yeah.
Yes, he has, yeah.
So he obviously has good intentions. I just think he's often a wee bit shrill when he approaches opposition, like he has, you know, folks with a green angle or an environmental angle or the cyclists, you know, he's been a bit shrill about them.
Yeah, he's not too keen on a cyclist, that's for sure, which is a bit worrying for somebody who drives a bus. For the cyclists anyway.
Yeah.
And Jim Hannon, who works down at the Fuller's desk down
at good old Jim.
Yes,
well, I was impressed with Jim running the Wharf to Wharf marathon, you know. And he tells me he's running again this year, but just the hard half, the uphill half.
Mm-hmm.
So and he's got the ability to put his mind to difficult things, yeah.
And I'm sure there's going to be many more as well. And then, of course, we have to turn to the current community board members, some of whom we know are standing and some we don't. Tony Sears has said that he won't.
Down, yes.
Yeah. 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 I think he's
sorry to see him go. I think he's done
a good effort,
job.
You know. Good man, yeah.
Yeah, Ray Erickson standing down.
Yeah,
sort of been sidelined from the community board for a while now.
Yeah, I think his health is not as robust as it could be, so yeah, that was expected, yeah.
Yep. Denise Roach has said she's standing.
Good.
Yeah,
so we've got... I'm not sure about Herb. Haven't heard.
Nor have I, but I would hope he would, because I think he's put in a pretty solid...
And Eileen...
Well, I would disagree. I think he's been not so good.
Yeah?
Anyway, there you go.
Yeah.
Eileen Evans, of course, is the Energizer Bunny. She'll be standing for the community board in 2020.
Yeah, no, she's done good community board stuff, you know, like the Teddy Bears picnic and the parade down the main street and all those kind of things. That's real community building stuff.
Mm. I mean, I disagree with her entirely on the Esplanade question, but we'll get onto that in a minute. But good on you, Eileen. I hope you're standing again.
That'll be good.
Okay, and the other existing community board member, Noble Angelo Karamalis, who I believe is standing again.
Well,
good luck to him.
His enormous sense of self-importance would, I'm sure, drive him to stand continuously. But I think...
Until the end of time, yeah.
Yeah. To the problem with the last election's public meeting, where those of us who knew a little bit about Noble Angelo prior to the election and who could have sort of sounded a few warning notes, we weren't allowed to. It's like, no, really, this guy sounds plausible. But there's a catch.
Yeah.
You know, really, really read the label before you vote for this man.
Yeah,
and a lot of people didn't. And of course, the island is full of people going, I can't believe I voted for that man.
Well, he had to be a one-term wonder, really. You know? So the chances of him becoming re-elected would probably be like the All-Whites winning the World Cup.
What was his vote count? 1,008 people.
1,008?
1,008. Wow.
Yeah. He was certainly nowhere near the bottom of the list.
Gosh.
No.
Less. And I mean, you know, it'd be interesting to see whether it's impacted on by the current court case or not.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we can't say much about this.
It's We've got to tiptoe around this one, which, of course, is you know, yeah. for me, I find this hard, really yeah. sad. I've made no secret of my distaste for this man and his activities over the years, and I would love to really sort of lay into him right now, but obviously I think we do have to tread yeah, around no, this one a little
I mean,
bit carefully.
I mean, he is charged, facing a charge of assault. He has pleaded put in a not guilty plea and will be defending the charge, so yeah. that's about all we can say on the matter.
Yeah, never mind, maybe next month.
Yeah, but
we'll look forward to that.
But
one.
What we can comment on his record as a community board member and his, you know, his strange sort of mix of policy directions. they didn't seem to be have a shred of common sense about any of them.
Not remotely. His spell on the community board has been a disastrous mixture of blinding arrogance and sheer stupidity.
And derailing,
but then I would have expected nothing.
And derailing the rest of the team. I really feel for Ray and Tony, the two chair people, trying to run through meetings with this guy, coming up with some every meeting there'd be bound to be something from completely left field, you know.
Well, it's going to make for an interesting election, isn't it? So we've got that list of candidates. So we've got Ewan, Denise, Faye, daughter, Joe, Paul, Alan, Jim. That we know, Noble Angelo, that's 9, potentially Herb and Eileen, 11, and probably some more to come out of the woodwork as well. So,
yes.
a good bunch for 5 positions there. Yeah.
Because, last time round, there were some lovely people stood, but really at the public meeting, it was embarrassing to watch. There were candidates who clearly didn't seem to know why they were there or what they were doing. I remember one in particular, when asked to talk about themselves, they talked about somebody else. And when asked to talk about their influences, they talked about themselves. Yeah. It's have you been drinking? This is a really unimpressive performance.
Yeah. Well, it's a strange, it's a wonderful kind of essay in democracy at work. You know, we put up the people, are they true reflections of our community, this group of people we had. And, you could argue that maybe Noble Angelo did reflect our wacky heritage or our fringe or whatever. But we didn't get our money's worth out of that.
I really don't believe so last time. I think there was a strong feeling that the incumbents who were standing again were going to be re-elected comfortably. It really was just a fight for Kellyanne Harvey's vacated seat. And at the public meeting, Noble Angelo put more work in. He was He was certainly more articulate than anybody else. The rest of them bumbled around and made a very poor showing.
He did do a lot of husting, Is that the word? When he accosts you at the door of the hardware store and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested to see with a pool of 12 potentially more people, what kind of campaigning would go on. I mean, it could be quite vigorous. We might, I don't know whether the Electoral Finance Act extends down as far as community boards, but I would say we'd be seeing a bit of money thrown around and certainly a lot of shoes being worn out.
Well, that brings up the question about money for your opinions. There have been full page ads recently where in the local press where someone takes out an ad saying,
that's quite,
this is my opinion about the pathway or the road.
So this is on the Esplanade, so let's take a look at that. But first, so there's kind of two issues around this, and I think the Esplanade issue itself and then this kind of debate and how the debate around it's conducted. So let's start off with the Esplanade. So we've had, there was an informal poll that was conducted, set up, I think, by the Cycling Action group Eileen. And that poll, unsurprisingly, come out with a result that people thought it should be closed. And that's what happens with those kind of polls. And then now we've got the City Council itself who have written to all of the ratepayers and asked for their opinion on that and the speed limit on Onatangi Strait. Yeah, so
which was a strange kind of thing. Upgrading the Esplanade doesn't mean they're going to close it off.
Well, there was a specific question about closing as well.
I just remember the word upgrading.
Right. Yeah, so how did you fill in your forms?
Well, I didn't receive one. I'm quite annoyed about that.
Yeah. And there was only one per household. So
one per ratepayer.
I filled mine on while sitting down by the fire. Someone else had the pen in the house, put it that way.
Has this poll closed now?
Well, here's because great journalistic integrity. I have no idea.
But anyway, the issue remains, what to do with the Esplanade? Do we block it off for horses and kids and bikes, or do we leave it as a secondary road?
I think if it's blocked off, it'll be a 9-day wonder. Everyone will go, oh, isn't this lovely? We can all go riding our bicycles and walking down there. And a month later, it'll be forgotten about. It'll be overgrown and falling to bits.
Yeah, but people are planning a Waiheke-wide, round Waiheke walkway. So I think that will become part of it for sure.
You know? If it's blocked off, I suggest we change the name from the Esplanade to Sanctimony Street.
Sanctimony Street. Sanctimony Stroll.
Perhaps. Yes, and then there will be just one road connecting the rest of the island to the Oneroa Matiatia area.
But that argument
And if,
is,
if there was a big slip on the road, then that's it. You can't.
But that argument is also... Say there's an emergency and we want to get an ambulance between Ostend and Matiatia because we need to get somebody on the ferry in a rush. The bit from where we're sitting now, from Artworks down to Matiatia, there's no option, no alternative either. So there's a... We're already stuck with a single... single alternative. That's not the right word, but
that's just the last little bit.
Yeah,
I think cutting off part of the roadways between the rest of the island and here.
Wouldn't it be as simple as putting a key for a bollard in the ambulance?
That's what I think. Yeah, but then people say the key would be lost at the crucial moment.
Yeah. And I like driving down the Esplanade.
Yeah, well, people drive quite slowly generally.
Yeah.
And it's also a rite of passage for Waiheke teenagers to take that corner a little too fast and take mum's car over the edge into the tide and then have, you know, the embarrassment of having it rescued the next morning.
That's true.
It's just what gets done.
Yep.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to miss out on that. Now, the whole question, though, has vexated some people, and there's been, well, we saw a full-page ad in the Gulf News, which isn't a cheap thing to do, from Tony Pope, saying keep the road open. And
then this week we got a snippy little letter saying, oh, it's not fair that some people can afford a full page and the rest of us just have to write letters. Shut up.
Yeah, but that letter still got printed for free.
Of course.
And when
it
you
did.
Think of the column inches that were once devoted to Noble Angelo, he got his mileage there.
Oh, yes. I mean, the Gulf News in particular, I thought, cravenly pandered to Noble Angelo. They just let him use it as a soapbox. And they did themselves a great disservice with
but
that.
But was it entertainment value? You know, there was a time when you read their letters for the amusement value, and then I gave up. And then I penned a letter in my head, which I never wrote, a one-liner that said, shorter letters, please, Noble Angelo. Yeah, but the novelty wore off quite quickly.
Do you think that...
I would say, though, with the likes of Tony Pope, yes, of course, he's got the money to take out a full-page ad, but... Really, does that help your cause?
No, it's just about.
I think it actually looks. It makes your cause look worse if you have to take out a full page.
Yeah, and does
it
have any more weight in the end, or do people take any more notice of the opinions in those full page ads than they do in a letter?
Less, I would suggest.
I'd say less. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Because we have seen it before as well. We saw it. From Bill, whose last
Bill
name?
Bill Carrick.
Yeah, Bill Carrick wrote his letter about Noble Angelo, actually. Going back to that again, trying to avoid
it. Peters of Waiheke
But there
politics.
Again, I think that in Bill Carrick's case, that was a reaction to the cowardice of the local media. And we saw this throughout the last 3 years. Neither the Marketplace or the Gulf News have really had the courage to stand up to Noble Angelo. The only person who's ever asked him some proper journalistically correct questions was yourself. They just let him do it. They've adopted a policy of we can't say anything about Noble Angelo because he'll shout at us. and I think that reflects poorly on both papers. Yeah. They
but
really should
we
have
haven't heard his
that.
Opinion on the Esplanade yet. Do you reckon it's beneath him?
I have not.
I don't think he probably has. I think the thing is it's somebody else's initiative.
I don't think
he's remotely interested in what anyone else has to say.
Because the one
it's
thing,
his initiative.
The one thing about
count.
The Esplanade that would be Noble Angelo's response, I would imagine, is why not make it a one-way road. keep it a car road, but make it one way, and that would suit his kind of style of politicking anyway, one way. But no one's ever seriously considered that. If we wanted an emergency route, make
so
it one way from Ostend to Matiatia, because that's the only way the emergency
is there an issue that would move either of you to take out a full page ad in the Gulf News?
That's a good question.
For myself, it would have to be...
Begging for arms,
Prohibition.
Yeah, something to do with alcohol. If they closed down all the bars, I'd probably take it.
What about the mini bars? Do you think there are mini bars on Waiheke?
Well,
which
maybe
leads
there are.
Us on to something
yes,
more
so of course, the big issue this week in the national news is the credit card spending.
Ah, lovely.
And the glorious smell of political careers going up in smoke. Could there be anything nicer than watching a politician go down?
Shane Jones, most likely not now the next leader of the Labour Party.
Yeah. Now, isn't it funny that if you'd asked me this time last week, and I mean, I watch politics pretty closely, if you'd said Shane Jones to me, I couldn't have put a face to a name this time last week.
I could have, I've heard the stories about him being the next leader.
Yeah, yeah. And yet overnight, he's New Zealand's most celebrated onanist. Everyone knows his name, but nobody wants to shake his hand, like the guy in the song.
But at least he's keeping the late-night movie video rental industry alive, you know, as well as the chocolate bars in the minibar.
Yes. Well, he's obviously had to keep his strength up.
It must be bad parenting, you know, because I would have thought it's the duty of a modern-day parent to say, one of the basic ground rules you tell your kids is, don't touch the minibar!
Yeah. The minibar is sort of there as a terrible warning of how silly life can get.
How you can get ripped off.
Yes, the thing about Tim Grosser at Copenhagen. Now, all right, I admit, if I'd gone to that absurd climate change conference and had to hang around with all those idiots mouthing nonsense, my first thought would be strong drink. But I've done a fair bit of travelling. I've stayed in hotels, and I know how this is done. You use duty free.
Well, you take a
you buy yourself
a
bottle
dairy.
Of single malt scotch, and you take it to your hotel and you drink that. You don't touch the mini bar. That's the mini bar's not there to be drunk. That's just there for a horrible warning of how nasty your life could
the
be.
The part that gets me is you're on the Crown's business, whatever you call it. You're being sent overseas to represent New Zealand. You're sitting in a lonely hotel room. Oh, that comes with the territory, part of the job. You open your wallet and you look at your array of credit cards. And you say, I think I'll use the ministerial one now.
Yes.
For the movies. Or the guy bought the golf clubs.
Should I use my own card for this? Oh, no, I'll use the ministerial one. I can always pay it back.
His defense was his own card would have declined. I suppose it's embarrassing if you're the MP and your card says declined. So he didn't use his own card, he used the ministerial.
Yeah, he spent that $130,000 a year on
exactly,
something
exactly. Under what circumstances could somebody on an outrageous salary like an MP possibly have their credit card declined? And if they do, are they really in a fit person to be running anything?
Oh, it's fantastic stuff. Yeah, I love it. But I think what's interesting is how the amnesia we have with, you know, if you look at yesterday's paper, there was this list of people that had done bad things, spent up large. And I like the Helen Clark bit where she had $19 for the gumboots.
A pair of gumboots.
But we're forgetting the, what is it, $14,000 that Rodney Hyde spent on his girlfriend and the $30,000 rort that the Minister of Finance did with over years with his rental subsidies. You know, how come those are all forgotten? Those are a lot bigger levels than the 20 movies which have been paid back.
Do you think there's more... Is it like one of those things where it's increasing or just the reporting of it is becoming more vigorous? I mean, is this something that's always happened?
That periodically we do this, we show that these people are not above the law. MPs have got to be held to a higher standard of accountability. And I think this whole exercise of dragging them out into the street and publicly thrashing them, it's healthy. It's good.
I feel for the journalist who's got to wade through 7,000 pages of credit card returns.
I think there'd be a lot of journalists for whom it would be worth it. You'd be going through and just suddenly go, oh, look at what I found. But I'll bet right now there are members of Parliament who are sitting there going, oh, my God, any minute now they're going to find that bit where I did that.
Well, maybe that's what Shane Jones was clever enough to fess up first. But I've been working on a theory about this. I reckon politicians of all flavours are put there just to show us our own foibles. They're there as mirrors of our frailty. And my theory kind of is strengthened by the fact that when we don't have them working, like the time when Winston Peters had us all holding our breath for a couple of months, wasn't it? You know, everything worked. The buses arrived, the movies started, the schools opened.
Of course they do.
Yeah, they
would like us to believe the country won't function without them, but in fact it does.
But the thing is, if we didn't have them, we wouldn't have this entertainment of the... You know,
I thought one of the more entertaining aspects of this story was Parakura Horimiya, the former minister of pies. His credit card bills were full of restaurants, pie shops, late night chip shops, kebabs, and Possibly we should be more worried about that. I mean, let's face it, the man is obese.
Yeah.
And his spending is clearly not doing him any harm. Shane Jones, I mean, we're only going to be worried about him when he starts blinking myopically and wanting an optometrist. Mm. But Parakura Horimiya, really, mate, you should stop eating.
It's
so much.
Not a healthy lifestyle, though, is it? No. I mean, it's the getting around, constantly away from home, living
nobody
in hotels.
Nobody forces
them
to do
and,
it.
Yeah.
Sorry, no
well,
sympathy
they
for
want to do. They want to do it. There's that lovely quote, show business for ugly men. What should we call politics after this week? It's show business for credit card groupies or what?
Yes. Credit card crazed drunk fat onanists.
Yeah, yeah. It's a job for someone who has a credit card problem.
So you're not a believer in the line that they do it for public service?
Not remotely. I think anyone who believes that is a fool.
Yeah, it's all about ego now.
I mean, you look at the average politician and think back. You knew these people at school. Mm. You grew up with people like this, the self-important, pompous little scumbags who, once they get into power, preside over a loathsome system of punishing taxation, levies and fines that keep everybody on their knees. I have no sympathy whatsoever. I'd like to think of myself as a compassionate man. Ordinary human suffering does affect me, but the suffering of a politician fills me with joy.
Yeah,
and watching these people squirm, I feel great this week.
Well, that does fall in line with your previously espoused theory that government should be just run by a bunch of experts, people who just...
Who are actually required to go and do it.
Yeah.
A database is searched. Who is the greatest expert on this subject? Ministerial car will then turn up at that person's door and say, I'm sorry, you're obliged to.
But isn't it
the better you do your job, the sooner you can go home.
Isn't
what
the
about
theory,
wages,
though?
It's quite a good theory because the government of experts has to be a better option than government by egotists.
But isn't that exactly the line that Rodney Hyde has been feeding us about the CCOs?
No, I don't buy that, not for an instant, because his line would only work if it was provable. But so much of the privatization argument, especially when it comes when you're talking about facilities, utilities, just doesn't work. There's some things you have to spend money on and there is no profit motive or margin that can be made in them. You know, and it's proven. In the Roger Douglas days, they said, electricity will be cheaper once we privatise it. Well, it hasn't got cheaper.
No.
It's got significantly more expensive. And that's just one example. Roger Douglas is just wrong, and Rodney Hyde is just wrong. Proven wrong. End of story.
Yes, I know. I voted for the guy.
No, but it's true. They've been proven wrong. You tell me your argument would only hold up if electricity would be substantially cheaper now than it was 10 or 15 years ago. It's not. It's electricity's gone up much more than the rate of inflation and the cost of living. So in that score, the argument just falls down completely.
Mm. And maybe it all just really comes down to who you've got running the thing, doesn't it? And
No, it's to do with population densities and what a community's expectation of service is. We have a first world expectation of electricity supply, but we don't have a population density or an economy big enough to support, so it becomes an expensive issue, expensive commodity, and if private enterprise runs it, we pay. If it's subsidized by government, that's just what the story is, you know. Either we pay more through private enterprise running it, or we end up having to have it subsidised by government.
Clear cut.
In my mind, anyway.
Maybe I'm not going to rise to the bait of this. I'm still feeling too good about Shane Jones.
Oh, yeah, no, isn't that a lovely story?
Mind you, of course, we're within the next week still on this subject. The one I really do hope goes down is Chris Carter. I think he is one of the most unforgivably loathsome MPs in Parliament.
Well, he's not in government right now, so...
Well, true, he's not in government,
he's
but...
He's
His record of sleazy utterance, of arrogant behaviour, he's the one I really wanted to see go down.
Yeah.
He is a thoroughly unpleasant man.
Yeah, but I think it works on both sides of the political divide. Both of the major parties have had ongoing, long-standing issues with their candidate selection. You know, they put up candidates and inevitably, they come out looking dodgy. So what is it with the candidate selection process that's wrong? Is it pandering to egos once again?
I think, coming from the union movement and seeing, you know, sometimes we see people there going into Labour, and I think you're right that the candidate selection system is where these people need to pay attention.
But then
somebody raised the interesting point yesterday in the Herald that if Phil Goff doesn't move against the likes of Shane Jones and Chris Carter, he's sending the message that these guys are irreplaceable, and that's really the best that he can come up with.
Yeah.
Which is a scary thought.
Do you think there's any chance that he won't move against them?
I hope not. I mean, I hope he does.
I'm sure something will happen. But, you know, once again, it's double standards. What did John Key do with Bill English when he was, you know, done for $30,000? This is a lot more than a couple of blue movies. $30,000 of rorting, you know?
Mm.
And English kept his position.
Yeah.
Rodney Hyde kept his position, which is very powerful, you know, in the current climate. So, you know, if we're asking for heads to roll, they should other heads should have rolled already. So it just goes back to my theory that these guys are there for entertainment, and you know, Shane Jones for me is the ace of the week for the entertainment he's offered us.
Absolutely.
And yes, I guess we can hilarious. Just be thankful that community board members don't get a credit card.
Yes. And also that unlike Shane Jones, community board members generally don't refer to themselves in the third person. That was really embarrassing to listen to.
Yeah, I'm a red blooded bloke.
Yes. No, Shane's a red blooded bloke.
Is he
says,
Shane's a...
You just referred to yourself in the third person. That is so embarrassing. You should lose your job for that alone.
All right.
Yeah, well, let's just hoping the community board elections can provide us with the same amount of entertainment, and let's find a new form of entertainment other than Noble Angelo this
time. I'm sure we'll touch on this again before the elections
Absolutely.
In October.
Noble Angelo, you ain't off the hook yet. Just because we can't talk about you this month doesn't mean we're not going to next.
See you next time, mate.
Okay, that's the Opinionated Islanders, Alan Knight and Alex Stone, and they join us next month. We should be back on to the first Saturday of the month, and in a moment we're going to find out about the midwinter dip. You're on Island Life on Waiheke Radio. Island Life is brought to you by Island, stockist of the island's most eclectic collection of local gifts, art and clothing, and you can find them in Ocean View Road, Pony Rower. The weather's taken a turn for the worse for sure now. We've got those cold nights and the wind and the rain. So what better time to go down to the beach for a swim? Well, anyway, that's the suggestion of Mitch Malloy, who's here with me today from St. John. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
So what madness has overcome you?
Well, the same madness that I had last year, actually. And last year proved to be a fantastic day. So nice, sunny, bright. Water was a little bit on the chilly side, but lots of people went in. So hopefully we'll have the same again this year.
So the midwinter dip has become a bit of a tradition down at Little Winnie Rower, is that right?
Well, this is our second year in a row, so I'm hoping it will become a bit of a tradition. I think it's nice to have something going on in the middle of winter where everyone can get together and have a bit of a laugh. It's our main fundraising for the year for the ambulance here on the island, and last year, like I say, was really popular, and I just would really like to build on that again.
So this is all not just insanity, but it is for a cause, isn't it?
It is for a cause, yeah. It's actually the start of the nationwide appeal week for St. John, which is from the 20th to the 27th of June, and this is just our way of kicking it off for something local, and all the money that we raise from the midwinter dip stays here on the island, which I believe is really, really important.
Yeah, and what's the focus of your fundraising?
This year we've actually got quite a big goal in mind. We need to replace our current frontline ambulance, so we're wanting to start getting funds together to actually do that. The time frame for that will be a little bit longer than just this one week, but this is going to kickstart it off.
So, you know, how much money do you need for an ambulance? You can pick up a van for, what, $7,000, stretcher, blanket, first aid kit?
For an ambulance, we need around $150,000.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Okay. So what kind of time frame are you looking at to raise that?
We're looking at around the two-year mark, although what we're hoping to do is to sell our current ambulance, and so that would be a big fund injection into that.
So if someone's looking for an ice cream van or something?
No, it's actually we're hoping to be able to sell it to another ambulance region, somewhere that it'll be better suited. It's not quite suited for the terrain that we have here.
Right, so you're going to kind of four-wheel drive, that kind of thing? Or?
It is currently a four-wheel drive, yeah. And we believe we no longer need a four-wheel drive here on the island.
Oh, okay, because it's we've gone up market and the driveways aren't so rough.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
That's exactly it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Oh, that's good stuff. And so So how do you make money out of the Midwinter Dip?
So the way that we do it is that we ask for participants to grab a sponsorship form, and sponsorship forms are available at different places throughout the island, ASB in Onirawa, Nourish Cafe in Ostend, the ambulance station in Ostend, and also the Beachfront Cafe in Onitangi. Grab a sponsorship form, and essentially what you're doing is asking people to sponsor you to do the Midwinter Dip, or in essence kind of dare you to do the Midwinter Dip. You do the dip, they front up with the money, and the money gets donated to St. John.
Good stuff. Okay, and you got a good pick up on that so far?
Hopefully we have. I don't know exact numbers, but there certainly is a little bit of talk in the general community about the Midwinter Dip. One of the things that we're doing is that we are encouraging people to dress up, have a bit of midwinter fun in that way. We've got prizes for teams, we've got prizes for individual adults, individual children. We've got a family prize this year, which is pretty awesome. And just sort of get into the whole spirit of it. And with that, hopefully that'll encourage a lot of people to come along.
Yeah. And if on the day someone decides, right, I'm going to go down anyway, they can kind of get along and kind of sponsor themselves by throwing a few notes in the tin.
Absolutely. We've got all our cadets out with collection buckets like they did last year, and they'll rattle them in front of lots of people, and hopefully, even if people just want to come down and enjoy the atmosphere and hopefully chuck a couple of dollars in the collection bucket, that would be awesome.
Great. And what are you dressing up as?
Me? Well, that would be a secret. Can't give that one away.
All right. What was last year's costume?
Actually, just a pair of togs for me.
Oh, okay.
Very boring.
Okay. All right, so that's good stuff. And the time?
The time is 10 o'clock,
yep.
10 a.m. at Little Oniroa. We've got Jim Mora and Mary Lambie emceeing the event for us this year, which is fabulous. We've got a mystery judge who's going to judge the fancy dress for us. We've got loads and loads of prizes, lots and lots of spot prizes. We've got some fantastic sponsors, which is awesome, and they've given us the prizes. We've got a sausage sizzle going. We're going to be selling hot soup, real hot soup, and we're going to have coffee available, obviously, at Little Oniroa store. So yeah, it'd be a really fun event.
Excellent, and a good way to make some money as well. So okay, at 10 o'clock, that's next Sunday, the
20th of June,
mm-hmm, at down at Little Oniroa. So yeah, we'll be playing notices about that, but do get along, get one of those sponsorship forms as well. Cheers, Mitch.
Awesome, thanks very much.
Okay.
Rebecca Armstrong is president of the Waiheke Coast Guard. They've just taken possession of a brand new boat, and Rebecca came in to tell me all about it.
So Rebecca asked me not to ask too many specific questions about it. So what colour is the boat?
Red, Coast Guard red and white.
And does it go fast?
It does go fast. They had it in trial runs in the sea trial. It went up to 39 knots and a 2-foot chop, so we're very happy with that. It's a lot faster than the old boat.
Yeah, yeah. So you can get around and save people all that much quicker.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. So you get the boat, you have to outfit it and stuff as well, or do they just kind of come as a, there you go, open
We've
it
been
up.
Involved with them. This boat's been built over the last year. It's more than a year ago it started, and all our gear has been taken over to the boat builders and installed as they've gone along, so towards the end of it. So it's all there and all ready to go, essentially, and we're just now learning to use it because it's quite a different boat to the last one. It's got twin jets, the other one was outboard. It's quite different to handle. There's some new electronic systems on there that we need to learn about. So yeah, no, it's really good.
So you've all been busy training, and have you had to put it into action, real action yet?
Real action, we have three times so far. Just been a boat of opportunity out in the water when something's gone wrong, so yep, we have, but we're not officially operational until probably another week away.
Okay, yeah. So, and then you'll be back on your regular roster of patrols and so on, will you?
Yeah, so we go on to all the boats in the Hauraki go into a roster of duty boats, and we essentially have one day a week where we cover. If there's a call out on the entire Hauraki Gulf, we go out there, and once every 6 weeks we end up having a whole weekend of duty boat, which means we're the main boat that they call on as well. So we'll be starting that probably early July.
Now, when the boat came over, I know you were keen for people to come down and have a look, and people, you know, have heard a bit about it and do want to check it out. So how can they do that?
Well, we're hoping to do an official launch of the boat in early July, possibly around the 3rd of July. We will put that out in the papers closer to the time when we know that, and we will have an open day where people can come through the boat and we can show them the gear and tell them how we work and things like that.
Good stuff. It would be nice to be over that hurdle, I suppose, and to be able to kind of get back to what it is you do.
Yes, absolutely. We were hoping to have this boat sort of September last year, so it's been a long delay, and we're really keen to get back out there and do our stuff.
Yeah. And have you got a full complement of volunteers at the moment?
We do at the moment, yeah. We've got about 9 operational crew, about the same in trainees, and we're always after anyone else who's keen to join up, who's available to come out, particularly if you're on the island during the day, because we do have a number of our crew work in town, so it's nice to have sort of more people on the island. But as long as you're sort of within a 10-minute drive of the boat, which is down in Matetia, then we're keen to hear from you.
Yeah, I've never really thought about the weekday stuff before. I mean, you kind of just imagine, I don't know, weekend boaties and forget about the fact that people are out there during the rest of the week.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely, we get called out all times of day, even in winter.
Great.
Especially in winter.
Yeah. So are you heading around to the midwinter dip next week?
Probably, yes. Make an appearance.
Yeah.
Support our local emergency services.
Good stuff. So, okay, so that's early July for the official launch.
Yeah,
so what are you doing now these days? You're it's not inflatable, is it?
It does have ribs, yeah. So it's a rigid hull inflatable ROB. So it has it's an aluminium boat essentially. But it's got some inflatable ribs around the side, so that when we go up and against boats, we're not sort of making too hard a contact with them. And
Yeah. So you won't be smashing bottles on it then?
No.
Do people still do that? Do they still? Or is that just the queen who gets
to smash? I do believe
they
still do that. Now we'll be doing some spraying of champagne, I think.
Yeah, Lindau. Marque Vu. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There's not much left in the budget after buying the boat.
No, not at all.
All right, okay, so we'll keep an eye out for that. And thanks for popping in. And next month we'll get back to our regular safety talks. So,
great, yeah. Look forward to it.
Okay,
thank you.
Cheers, Rebecca. It's Rebecca Armstrong, President of Waiheke Coast Guard. And look out for notices about the launch of their flash new red boat. It's very nice.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, and the interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. They're also available as a download from our website, www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Island Life is brought to you by Island, the shop with Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Island, Ocean View Road, Onirola.